Hello and a very good evening to you. My name's David Jay. Welcome to the June edition of Suzy Radio's Cricket Chat Show. Welcome to On the Front Foot. Tim Bowling's here with me. Be saying hello to Tim in just a moment. Tim and I, on our own to start off with, we're going to have a little chat among ourselves about issues locally and more widely in the game in the month since we were with you last. It's all a little bit of an inexact science this evening. We have got two guests coming in later. Towards the end of the show, we've got Sanjay Patel, who's the chair of Salford CC. And dependent on when he can get away from an earlier commitment in Redhill, I'm delighted to say that Crispin Blunt MP is going to be with us, not as a politician, but as a cricketer, to talk cricket. Tim, good evening.
Good evening, David. How are you?
I'm not so bad, all things considered. And let's not talk about the trains for a change.
No.
Still hopeful, are we not, that Chris Jacobs may join us later?
I think he's travelling back down from Nottingham today, so hopefully he'll be here at some point.
So if he does, he does. And yeah, if he doesn't, exactly. He doesn't. And it's down to you and me to hold the metaphorical fort until Mr. Blunt arrives. And I thought that as in our three shows so far this year, we've talked a good deal about general aspects of the game and areas wider perhaps than our immediate little corner of North Sussex and East Surrey. We might just start five games into the league season. I know you haven't seen these, I'm springing them on you, but just have a little look at the league tables of those sides that I report on regularly during the afternoon stroll. We've done five lots on Wednesday afternoons now, apart from the one Saturday which was a virtual washout. And East Grinstead not having it all their own way in the Sussex Premiership this year. They've lost one game and they are 19 points behind Roffey, who are once more steamrolling everybody out of sight.
Who was the winners last year of the Sussex Championship? Was it East Grinstead?
East Grinstead won it fairly comfortably, yes. So they are defending it. And Ifield are in the Premiership. And they got totally blasted in the local derby last weekend, but won by Roffey, who rolled them over for 77, having got loads. So Ifield are down there in Threttsville in the Premiership.
Yes, I have actually seen the Premiership for Sussex and Surrey. They're the only two leagues I've managed to have a look at. But I think Ifield are just above the relegation zone. I mean, they're only five games in, but yeah, I think they're in the danger zone at the moment.
That's right. Now, the Llamas, you mentioned the Surrey Premiership, Reigate Priory stormed to the top by beating the defending champions last weekend very comfortably. That's Normandy. And Normandy down the table a little bit, and Priory's old rivals Weybridge are in second place.
That's a tough league, isn't it? When you look at that Surrey Premier League, and same with the Sussex Premier League, there's some very good teams in that particular division. But yeah, Reigate Priory on top, that's good news.
I suppose you would think that among those names it's Normandy and Cranley and Ashtead, perhaps to an extent East Molesey, who are the out-of-town sides as opposed to the really big names there.
Yes. I remember playing at Normandy Cricket Club a few years ago, and they're very fortunate because they've got two grounds within the two pitches within the same ground, so they can host various different sides. And I remember seeing I've forgotten his name. What was the name of the England leg spinner that came? Chris Schofield.
Yes.
He was playing for Weybridge against Normandy. And we finished our game slightly early and we watched him, and he was batting, no helmet on. He was on 150 not out. He was absolutely creaming the ball around the pitch. This is as a batsman rather than a bowler. And it showed you the difference between a player who's a good club player and a player who is an England player. And he was batting absolutely brilliantly. But it's a lovely ground down there in Normandy. I've played there several times.
So. And that's somebody who at county level is 10 jack at the best,
let alone the few test
caps. Did Scoey not come back and play a few T20 games for Surrey a couple of years back?
That's right, because he went out of the game for a while and he couldn't get a contract, and I think that's when he was starting to play again for the likes of Weybridge, and then he came back in and started playing some county cricket again. But he seems to have disappeared, and I guess he's probably of an age now where he's probably slightly too old. But yeah, he did come back for a little while.
The other thing with one eye on the top of the hill just outside our FM range change, but as far as the Premiership is concerned, Banstead back in the Premiership and in third place with a young side.
Yes, again, a good club, Banstead. In the old days, they had David Ward, didn't they, down there as a coach?
Oh, yeah, Nick Faulkner played there for a while with Wardy. They had some serious contenders.
I scored
there.
My highest ever score at Banstead Cricket Club, 88.
Really?
Yeah, at Banstead.
You did me by two. I got 86 in a third team game on the ground out the back, which in those days was one of the best wickets we ever played on.
Funnily enough, mine was a third team, and I think we were on the 13 pitch as well. But I remember it was one of the times where I was seeing the ball like a football. And it's not often that happens.
And Richard Condy, who I think may now be the chairman of Banstead, or he's still in the Banstead management somewhere, he and a chap who came on to work at the grammar school at Hartswood called Clive Wesson ran cricket ground services when people couldn't afford their own groundsmen and contracted out.
Yeah.
And got to know them at that stage as well.
Banstead, they weren't in the Premier League last year, then?
They've had a couple of seasons out and they've had to fight their way back.
I was going to say, I'd always consider Banstead to be one of the top sides in Surrey, so that's good that they're back up there.
But then you look at some of the sides lower down the divisions, you know, it's now Oxted and Limpsfield, no longer Oxted plus Limpsfield, and there are other sides, you know, Maldon Wanderers aren't in the Premiership.
No, it's funny, isn't it? It's clubs that you assume will be there that aren't actually there, that have sort of dropped down a little bit, but yeah.
And just skimming down, I know this isn't in front of you, Tim, but skimming down to Division 5, Merstham won off the bottom. They haven't had any sort of a start at all.
Yeah, it's a great shame. We have a lot of friends at Merstham Cricket Club, and it's a shame that they're not doing so. Hopefully that'll pick up as the season goes on. It's been tough conditions the first few weeks of the season, to be fair.
That's right, and they beat Guildford City, who are the one side below them at the moment, and their perennial rivals Merrow, who came up with them having contested the promotion the season before. Merrow played 5-30 points, Merstham played 5-28 points, so it's all very tight there. But perhaps a little bit more worryingly, and without going into it too much now, Merstham's lower sides not going well at all.
No, it's a shame. Do we know, what do they have, three Saturday sides?
Four. Poor old Ian Lamont's fourth haven't played the last 2 weeks because the opposition haven't raised a team.
Well, as we've said many times before, haven't we, it's difficult, isn't it, to try thirds and fourth 11 sides now, very difficult to try and get proper teams out for that.
That's right. Sussex Division 2, a club that we don't really deal with, we must try and get them in at some stage. This is Three Bridges.
Yes.
And they're topping Division 2 by 3 points from Mayfield, who are very much on the up and up. Mm. They're from East Sussex.
Right.
They were in Burgess Hills League last year and clearly out to make a name for themselves. And then Billingshurst, who are a useful side. And you look down Division 2 and it's Bognor Regis and Haywards Heath and Chichester Priory. I mean, they're all good sides.
Yeah, there are some good teams in both those leagues, aren't there.
Now, Division 3 East, which is where my friends from Burgess Hill play, Crawley Eagles. And Crawley Eagles got absolutely turned over at Cherry Lane by Preston Nomads seconds last weekend.
Wow.
So Crawley Eagles, not high-flying, one game lost, and they're, where are we, 12? They're 14 points off the pace. I've seen Portslade, they're one of the South Coast sides, and they're a good side.
Yeah, Portslade, they're a good team.
East Grinstead 2s are in that division as well, and then Division 4 West, it's really not looking good for Crawley themselves. Played 5-1 none, one off the bottom.
Yeah, that's difficult. The problem is, it's like all sports, you get into a bit of a run, it's quite difficult to try and get yourself out. I mean, things can change around quite quickly in these leagues, and you do tend to find that it's not always the sort of layout of the league at the start of the season that you see at the end. And people, when you start getting players back, certain clubs are stronger when they have the players come back from university and these sorts of things, and things can change round, so it's not over and done with yet.
The Surrey County League, the Fullers, obviously we have got Newdigate, John Colcutt's club, in the Premiership and comfortably holding their own, and three local sides together there, 4th, 5th and 6th in the Fullers Premiership. That's Chaldon CMO, whom I unforgivably called Croydon CMO because, of course, my memory going back as far as it does, it's Chaldon plus Croydon MO, Croydon Municipal Officers. Yep. But I call them Croydon CMO live on air. So they're in fourth place with 66. Lingfield, who are another club that's going places, they're fifth with 54. And Newdigate are sixth with 46. So they're comfortably off the bottom.
Yep.
And Hawley have had a successful start to the season in Fuller's Division 1, but they're still only in fifth place, 54 points.
Yeah, well, we've got a representative from Hawley coming in, I think it's next month, isn't it? July.
Well, not just any old representative. Well, Trevor Stevens, 15 overs at the weekend, and he took 6 for 21, or whatever it
really?
Was.
Well, we'll have plenty to talk about then.
Trevor's not that far short of my age. I mean, I played cricket against Trevor Stevens for a very, very long time. And I think you've got Tadworth, hopefully, signed up to come in at some point.
Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah, we've got quite a lot of clubs, actually, that are in the wings waiting to come on, so it's good.
Well, this is good. We're just a little bit short tonight.
It is
high summer.
Yes.
And, of course, we asked the grammar school, but both Phil Mann and James Leck are playing in a charity T20 at the Oval tonight.
Yes, so, that's right, I saw that. Yeah, that
so
should be quite fun.
We can't deny them
I
that.
Wonder what the crowd's going to be like for that tonight.
Oh, two men and a blind dog, I expect. No, I'm sure if it's a fundraiser, it will go really well. So, in the Surrey Downs Division 1, South Nutfield doing better. They're in third place. They've won 3 out of 5. But Nutfield, just up the road from us, Nutfield Marsh, have won 4 out of 5. East Horsley are just top. And then you've got Tadworth, and we'll be able to ask Sanjay Patel later on about Salfords, who are mid-table with 80 points, played 5-1-2, and Capel languishing. Rather, they're second bottom on 50 points. And in Surrey Downs 2, Salford seconds are actually in that league, and Brockham Green close to the bottom, 56 points, one off. And finally, for this little statistical roundup, really, and avoiding various second teams who are in Surrey Downs 3, poor old Ockley, who are right on the fringe of our FM area, down below Capel in geographical terms, and I suspect topographical terms too. Ockley played 5, won none, bottom of the table, points minus 13.
That's pretty bad, isn't it, I think. But, obviously, they've had some issues there. But, again, it's early days, isn't it? It's early days. But that, I have to say, the Surrey Downs League, there's some very picturesque clubs and grounds in that league, isn't there? I think if you're looking to maybe get back into cricket or play for a club, the Surrey Downs League is a lovely league to play in. There's some really nice grounds there that you can go and play cricket at.
Well, that, of course, is the reason all those years ago that Cats, Old Cateramians, call it what you will, our Sunday wandering side that grew out of White Oaks, the second side in Caterham, and this is 40 years ago and more now, that's the reason that we took the absolutely concrete decision to stop playing on a substandard park pitch, playing home games, become a Sunday wandering side. And once my great friend and now chairman at Burgess Hill, who's been in on this show, Mike Trowbridge, moved down to Mid-Sussex, then we started picking up village fixtures down there, which wasn't exactly the Surrey Downs, but the same sort of.
Well, I used to play for Charwell Cricket Club, and we tended to play nearly all our games at home throughout the season. We'd start in April and finished in October, and a lot of those fixtures were wandering sides that we'd been playing for years. You had the likes of Mogadore Wanderers and these sort of clubs coming over, and a lot of the clubs as well, other than the wandering sides, were clubs that also had their own lovely ground. So it's quite nice when you have those sort of teams coming to play at nice grounds. So,
of course, people are saying nowadays that the competition is everything and the points are what matter, and that the surroundings are semi-irrelevant and the quality of the tea is totally irrelevant to our way of thinking. All those years ago, that was exactly what it was all about, and a nice Sunday pub lunch before we went to the game.
Yeah, quite right, that's right. I mean, I remember playing at Lye Cricket Club, and we had a hot summer's day playing for Charwell at Lye, and I remember for tea we had Cornish pasty, mashed potato and baked beans, and when we went out to try and play afterwards, blimey, we were much slower in the field after that.
Oh, the boys down at Lye, when Simon Verley and Mark Holman and people who you know were a lot younger, and the three Chenery brothers, they were also from the grammar school, and it really made such a difference that you got people committed to making an all-day occasion
out
of a Sunday cricket match.
Exactly,
and, you know, we've had the conversation in all sorts of shapes and forms, but one of the great problems now is that nobody wants to play any more than than 40 overs if they can possibly avoid it.
That's right. Very sad.
The concept of cricket as a day out, let alone at a nice place, has just gone clean out of the window. Now, I should explain to our listeners that we're awaiting our first guest. That's Mr. Crispin Blunt, MP for Reigate, who's going to come in and talk about cricket. He's a member of Reigate Priory Cricket Club. It's a little bit of an inexact timetable tonight, and with our regular pundit Chris Jacobs off to America next week, and therefore with his last opportunity this year to come on the show, he is nonetheless travelling back from Nottingham, and we're not sure whether. But in view of that, and in view of the fact that we'll probably get a second go, Chris or no Chris, after we've spoken with Mr. Blunt, let's leave summing up the Pakistan series. I know there's loads to talk about, but let's leave summing that up for a moment. And perhaps we could consider the way, I know you're not in a position to see very much of it, but perhaps we could consider the way in which the Pakistani tour started with proper preparation. They played a game, albeit a preparation game, against Leicestershire, and then they played a test match against Ireland at Malahide, and of course that was Ireland's first
test
match.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
And Tim Murta, whom we all know from Surrey and Middlesex, his brother Chris is skippering the Priory again this year, and of course Tim played against the Grammars, against my sides at the Grammar School in the 90s, and he's now a venerable county cricketer, hugely successful with Middlesex, and a fine seam and swing bowler in English conditions. Tim Murta became a quiz question forever and ever. Who was the 11th person in the world to bowl his country's first ball in Test cricket?
Okay, there we go. I didn't know that.
Well,
know that.
If you think about it's completely logical. Yeah. And Ireland didn't equip themselves badly with Kevin O'Brien getting that wonderful 100 in the second innings. And as so often happens, whether it's a drinks break or an overnight, out without addition the following morning.
Yeah, happens very often, doesn't it?
And the game went down the tube.
Because Ed Joyce played, didn't he, in that particular test, for made his debut for Ireland and then promptly retired at the end of the match.
Well, there's something of a circle squared there,
yes,
isn't
true,
there?
True.
And almost 40 years old, a man with a venerable career in the same position as Clive Rice, the late Clive Rice, who skippered South Africa when they came back into the fold just over a quarter of a century ago, got his test cap and then moved on. But that was not by any means an humiliation. It looked as if it might be at one point, but Ireland gave a very good account of themselves against Pakistan, and of course in the wake of the barrage of criticism following England's demise, nay abject collapse at Lord's, a day and a bit of which I sat and endured.
Yes. Yep.
I was looking in preparation for this show a couple of hours ago through some of the newspaper cuttings that I always keep just to make a few ideas. I was absolutely amazed at the way in which the pundits in general, and Michael Vaughan in particular, didn't just get a hatchet out. I mean, it was Mark Ramprakash who they used to call Blood Axe. But, you know, for the sake of creating a stir, chucking a stone in the pond.
Yeah, I think you wonder sometimes whether they're saying these things to try and gain publicity for themselves, and now that they're not players anymore, or whether they're actually saying it because they genuinely believe what they're saying. Michael Vaughan in particular is very good at coming out with statements which are, well, you could describe as inflammatory if you were of a certain mind. It clearly, his comments regarding Stuart Broad clearly, and James Anderson, clearly had an effect, and the players responded. Now, Vaughan would claim, well, I did my job. I they needed a rocket putting up them, and that's what we did. But I'd sometimes wonder whether they say these things with the right intentions.
Michael Vaughan not actually being the England captain any longer and not being privy to what goes on in the dressing room.
Yeah, exactly.
So, interesting. The reason I raise that now is that off the back of the clamour for proper preparation, there's talk of slotting in a four-day test match between England and Ireland at the beginning of next season.
That. Yeah, I think they're trying to, I think they're partway through to getting approval, aren't they, to actually host that. Interestingly, it's a four-day test, though, which presumably is I don't know if that's to do with cost or why it necessarily has to be a 4-day test. But yeah, I read that today that they're trying to get the 4-day test.
I think there are a number of strands to that. In actual fact, the first is that for the moment the newcomers, which is Afghanistan and Ireland, and also the resurgent Zimbabwe, outside the very top bracket and outside the initial World Test Championship, I think there's a genuine sense that they may be good for 4 days and perhaps not for five. The other side of that coin, as I saw at Lord's, you know, the game was over at 12:30 on the Sunday, and we lasted with our picnic in the grandstand until 2:30, and then they chucked us out.
Yeah.
But of course, all of those ancillary staff and the bar staff and the waiters and all of those people and the security people paid by the hour, no doubt. It won't be a salaried position. And it seems that for every test match that goes 5 days and provides wonderful excitement, as when West Indies turned England over at Headingley last year. Interesting, isn't it, that the contrast in those two England performances at Headingley in not dissimilar conditions. But for every five-day game that goes like that, I think the thinking is that almost every fifth day loses money because they can't charge ticket prices and they've got to employ staff if they open the ground.
I mean, it'd be a great shame, though. My worry is that, I mean, we've discussed before about Test cricket and its future. My worry is that if you start going down the route where four-day tests are coming in, how long will it be before that becomes the norm? I know you're right. Very few tests these days last 5 days, and I appreciate the finances and the costs, etc. But I think it would be a real shame for four-day Test cricket to become standard and five-day cricket to disappear.
Commercial interests are talking very seriously again about four-day test matches. It's the almighty dollar or pound or Bitcoin or whatever it may be. I was thinking earlier today about the fact that it's 15 years and more since Giles Clarke took over first and foremost to do the ECB's marketing.
That's right.
And from that moment we went down the tubes. The point that somebody made, I think, in the book that I want to talk to you about later on, which I only received a copy of this morning and I've just skimmed, somebody made the point that it was in the summer of that triumphant Ashes series, which is reckoned to be there with Botham's Ashes and 1948, and we're talking about Michael Vaughan and 2005. It was the irony that at the end of that wonderful season, the cricket on television decamped to Sky, full stop, and that as a result, the marvellous quality, and we might get a chance to talk about the broadcasting later on, the marvellous quality of what Sky TV does, and I think their coverage is absolutely brilliant, but I'm lucky enough to have a Sky Sports package within my overall cable package, and it doesn't cost me a total arm and a leg, and I'm lucky enough to be able to afford it. But all that quality notwithstanding, from that point on, four-day cricket and five-day test cricket were lost to succeeding generations now.
Such a shame, almost a missed opportunity, wasn't it? Given the publicity that there was around that time for cricket, all of a sudden cricket was massive again. And you're quite right. Sky, fantastic coverage, probably the best coverage of any of the television broadcasters at the moment. But as you say, not on free-to-air TV. So a whole raft of young people not seeing it anymore, not being able to actually take advantage of that whole summer when cricket was massive.
And when I say succeeding generations, you know, 7 years is a generation in a school. So more than 14 years is two whole generations of boys, and thank goodness girls as well now, growing up from starting in the senior school, the secondary school, and either going all the way through to A-level in one school or doing their GCSEs, going off to sixth form college, coming out at the top of that and off to university, and that's two whole generations. And on top of that, we were talking about Phil Mann and James Leck earlier on top of that, if they're unlucky, they don't get a great deal of chance to play cricket at school, and the cricket that they're exposed to in the clubs is by and large 20 over cricket.
Yep.
In consequence of which, when it comes round to joining the men's sides at the age of 14, 15, 16 on a Saturday and Sunday afternoon, I haven't got time to do that.
No, and that's the problem. And also, when even if they do have time, they play, but they are just, they can't, it takes them a long time to get their heads around how for example, time cricket actually plays out, and they're just not used to playing those types of things. And that there can be no surprise when less quality players are coming through as a result of things like that.
I think as much as somebody, if I may say so, of middle age like yourself and a relatively old man like me, however much we may lament the loss of the timed game, it ain't going to come back.
No.
And we've said many times on this show, again in various shapes and forms, that it will be the short form and possibly the even shorter form as time goes by. And I think that's a great shame. Anyway, if there should be a four-day test against Ireland, I think that's wonderful for the newcomers among the international elite, and I think it's really good for the game, and it's another step in this broadening. We'll probably have a chance just to talk very briefly about the women's ODI, the first ODI, which is coming up on Saturday.
Yep.
And I mentioned broadcasting. I'm going to hold off that just a little bit longer, but being a gentleman of leisure as I am now, apart from when I'm sitting in this hot seat behind this microphone, there is cricket on the television virtually every day when I go home. It is quite extraordinary.
Well, we had the Indian Premier League, didn't we, recently, and now we have the Royal London Cup. You're quite right. You turn on, I mean, Sky are very clever now that they've repackaged their channels so that there's a Sky Football channel, Sky Action, I think it's called, and obviously Sky Cricket, and you can watch cricket of one shape or another 24 hours a day. It may be matches, it may be interviews, but there is something there all day long.
But what a wonderful irony that the very moment the discrete sports channels were inaugurated on Sky, they promptly lost the Australian Cricket Board's coverage and BT snapped it up.
Yeah, I know, that's right. Well, that's money, I guess, isn't it? It's, you know, other rival broadcasters putting in more money. But
we can go two ways. We can either stick with broadcasting, or you just raise the topic, the spectre of the IPL. What do you fancy?
Well, I have to say, I think I mentioned on the previous show, I, like Chris Jacobs, neither of us are great fans of the IPL. I love watching cricket, but when I switch on the TV and see the IPL on, often I'll watch it for a small period of time and switch off. If there's any other types of cricket on, I'll watch it, but I just struggle. I don't know what it is. I think it's overdone, and I think it's just not really for me, the IPL.
Sitting here on the afternoon stroll, you know I try to chuck in a bit of interesting music from time to time, and I mean music that will genuinely interest people, because ultimately, even if it's Susie Radio that's playing it, and even if it's Winston who's introducing it, I think that middle-of-the-road pop has always been middle-of-the-road pop, and it's one step away from audible wallpaper in airport lounges. And I fear, from my own experience, and I've tried to take an interest in the IPL, I fear that it's very much visual wallpaper. I mean, I get in round about 4:30, and the game is maybe an hour old, and it's going to go up to whatever time, 7, 8 o'clock. And because some of those games in the IPL go on after midnight, Indian time.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Which must be a strain on the players, you know, Tim.
Yeah, mind you, they're getting paid, the top players are getting paid a vast amount of money for that. But you're right, I mean, I guess they're professional sportsmen. You would like to think that they're capable of dealing with it, but it's not a natural sort of time slot, is it, to be playing those sorts of games. But the tournament just seems to drag on and on and on, and the Indians, quite right, they love it, and you see the passion there, which always surprises me, given that these are all relatively new teams. You know, the IPL has been around for what, 10 to 12 years now, and the fans are passionate about those sides, which I've always found odd, given that the sides have no real history. You know, you go back to the old Indian setup, and it was the various older sides who had a history. These clubs don't, and it's but the fans seem to love it over there.
And yet Lalit Modi is telling the ECB in no uncertain terms that if they don't farm the new tournament here out to franchises, it will not succeed. I find it very interesting that he also threatened. Actually, before I say that, let's just go back. Get home at 4:30. and the IPL chanters away in the corner.
Yeah, exactly.
And and very occasionally there will be a spectacular catch or whatever. Although, interestingly, Nick Knight was talking with Ebony Rainford Brent and Dominic Cork last night at the end of that extraordinary Royal London game at the Aegeus Bowl, where Somerset chased and got 357.
Yeah, incredible, isn't it?
Quite extraordinary. But Nick Knight was offering the view that while batting continues to reinvent itself and improve, in inverted commas, and while bowlers are coming to terms with the fact that it's the norm to go for 8 or 9 and over and reinventing their craft within those parameters, the fielding hasn't really improved at all. And if you think about it, the IPL, you see these occasional miracle boundary catches, which if you played on a 75-yard boundary would be normal boundary catches, but let's not go there. Significant, I think, last night that the Royal London, even though the Aegeus Bowl was short on one side, they hadn't left the wide open spaces the other. It was still pulled in so as the sixes could go sailing.
Yeah.
And that, to me, defeats the object. We've all done it on village grounds, for goodness sake. You know, which end are X and Y going to bowl? Where's the short boundary? Where's the long boundary? How are we going to manage this? And you wouldn't call it subtle, would you? I don't know whether I said last time, but to me, one thing that sums up the IPL is the way that it dovetails so beautifully with the hyperbole of Danny Morrison's commentary.
Yes. The problem I have with the IPL, I find, is that it I think maybe it's that we're starting to reach saturation point with... You know, when it first started and we saw these players hitting these massive sixes, it was a bit of a novelty and you thought, wow, that's impressive. You see players hitting sixes now and actually it's become the norm. And when someone like Josh Butler hit the six in the test match, and they talked, I think on TMS they talked about it as one of the the Brian Johnson champagne moment. I'm not sure which moment actually won, but he was in the list. And... To be actually remembered for one of those sixes, you have to literally hit the ball out of the ground now, because the boundaries of, as you say, have been brought in. I just think we've actually reached, with T20, we're reaching saturation point, and which would be a terrible thing, because it would actually end up being counterproductive. We're trying to get youngsters in, we're trying to get people into the game through that avenue, and if that becomes the opposite, what's the point?
I need to go two ways here now, and this is where sometimes I lose my thread.
Okay.
But first and foremost, I think in terms of making further changes, the threat that I mentioned just now is in this same article about the IPL and his role in running the IPL. Lalit Modi threatens that unless the new Test Championship, starting in 12 months' time, isn't properly organised and isn't a rip-roaring success, the IPL ought to run a Test Championship of its own.
Well, yeah, there we go. I mean, that tells you everything you need to know. And the problem is, it's that type of attitude, with just this whole money-grabbing attitude, that is going to end up destroying the entire game. We need money in cricket, there's no doubt about that. But when they start talking about rival tournaments and all this sort of stuff, that's when we're going to have major problems in cricket, and it's going to do the sport no favours whatsoever.
One of the elements of the whole IPL thing that raised its ugly head in March and April was the counties beginning to cut up about so many county players being away for the whole of that first swathe of four-day championship matches.
Yeah, well, exactly. And again, you know, those clubs and counties, they're reliant on those players to get a good start, and also to bring in spectators to those types of games. It's hard enough to get spectators into the county championship. When your marquee players aren't there, then you're really going to struggle.
They're struggling to fill grounds on a Wednesday evening with the 50-over Royal London, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Especially if the weather's a little bit dodgy. So, county players, the other thread, and I've remembered for once that I was going to say to you, is that inevitably time marches on, and many people haven't the length and breadth of experience that you have, never mind I. But people waxing lyrical about a champagne moment moment, because Joss Butler sticks somebody in the building site, probably wouldn't remember the morning that, or afternoon it would have been, that Botham sauntered down the steps to face Craig McDermott for the last two balls.
That's right. Was that 85?
One-day international, and stuck them both over his head a million miles straight into the...
Yes, I remember that.
You know, these things have happened before. But there we are. So, two things, really, off the back of the IPL now. I find it extremely regrettable. I've got two things here. Morgan tells game it faces a stark choice, adapt or die. That was in April. And a little bit before that, it is probably too late to save the test game, says Morgan. I worry about an England captain who has now gone back to get some experience in red ball cricket with Middlesex, talking the game down in those terms.
I just do not think he should be allowed to say that. Surely when with all the social media these days and everything else, surely the whole England setup, they have PR advisors that can actually make sure that these types of quotes don't go out. But Owen Morgan should not be saying that sort of thing. He's got a vested interest because he's the white ball England captain. I understand that, but equally, Test cricket should be protected at all costs. And I appreciate that it's difficult to make money and all that stuff, but ultimately, Test cricket should be protected. It should never be run down, especially not by an England captain, be he a white ball captain or red ball captain. It's completely outrageous.
This, I suppose, is Owen Morgan, who, at the age of 16... playing his first international game for Ireland, kept the team bus waiting to leave the ground for 10 minutes at the age of 16, and when the captain asked him what all that was about, he said, I was talking to my agent.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, that tells you everything you need to know. It's just, it's wrong, you know, in this day and age, it's totally wrong. Test cricket is under pressure, we know that, and it does not need England, top England players and captains running it down. It's just the worst thing that could possibly happen.
Tim, I've got a couple of things to reflect upon, because I was at the RAC cricket dinner in Pall Mall in the middle of last month, and I'd like to pick up on something that I heard by one of the two speakers there, and also something to do not with the book that I've got here on my right hand side, but another book that's been published very, very recently. But I think, given that we are still lacking our first guest and that we've been talking for the better part of 40 minutes, we should probably take the break now. Is that okay?
Yep, fine by me.
Susie 103.4, Sussex and Surrey.
Welcome back to On the Front Foot, part two, with David Jay and Tim Bowling flying as co-pilots, not exactly solo, but we're doing our best to soldier on through. Tim, I've just put the live Royal London scores up on screen. It's a very strange competition in that they've got a sort of playoff system the side that heads each group goes straight through to a semi-final.
Oh, is that
and,
right? Okay.
And two and three play off against one another, which they're calling quarterfinals, which clearly they aren't, because it's a last six. And the winners of those then go on to play the two winners in the actual semi-finals.
I didn't realise that was the format, actually, because there's two different groups, isn't there? I just assumed that it was the top groups from each, the top teams from each group that went through to the quarterfinals, then the semis.
So Essex and Kent will be playing off, having played one another last night. Oh, no, they won't play off against one another. They'll play against opposites from the northern group. Essex and Kent will be playing off, and Hampshire have gone through last night.
Yes.
Somerset chased 356, won the game and didn't go through.
No, that's right.
On my screen, Yorkshire are 123 for 4, chasing 241 by Northants. 119 to win from 21 overs with 4 out. Warwickshire 292 for 7 and Worcestershire 182 for 5. Worcestershire needing 111 from 24. Nottinghamshire have beaten Derbyshire by 8 wickets, and I think that secures their place. Derbyshire 110 all out, Notts 115 for 2, and at Durham 240 all out, and Leicestershire 151 for 2. Neither of those sides can qualify. And at Hove, Australia 277 for 9 in 50 overs, Sussex 134 for 3, needing 4, 4 from 25.
Yes, yes. It's interesting that that there's no... do you find it odd that there's no test cricket at all now until August?
I find it extraordinary.
Is that... do you think that's because the Football World Cup's on, or do you think that's because they've scheduled it to try and get the Royal London Cup done, or...?
Oh, come, come. I'm sure that's not the case. I mean, we've had a whole fortnight without football.
I just... it's incredible. If you'd said to me when I was a kid that there'd be no test cricket throughout the summer, the main part of the summer, until August, I would have just laughed at you.
Well, you know, the weekend after next would have been Wimbledon and the Lord's Test all going on at once. Huge occasion in London. Anyway, that's where the Royal London is at the moment, and this strange IPL-style again conference. Let's have football playoffs and extend the season by another month.
Why do they tinker with it? Why do they make it so complicated? I mean, fans surely don't want that. They just want a nice, straightforward... have two groups, have the top teams play off in a knockout and go through to a semi-final then a final.
If you want to attract people, I've always been a great believer in keeping it simple.
Yeah.
But there we go. Okay, well, let's take a little look. We may have to save the Australian One Day series because we've got so much here to talk about until later. But I've now found my bit of paper and an extract from James Taylor's new autobiography, and nothing more unfortunate in the world than James Taylor's experience with that almost terminal heart attack that he suffered, and these appalling, graphic, unsparing accounts in his book of what happened to him and how it all took place and how they saved his life, and what a great shame. But this article now, and clearly he's also making his way as a pundit.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. Which is a good thing to see. He's going to be a scout, and he is also a confident and articulate young man.
Well, he had the temerity to go up against Bob Willis the other night in a particular... I can't remember what the argument was about, but he's not afraid of giving his opinion.
I think for once the Justice in Chief might have been marginally tired and emotional, which is not the usual state. But I think he'd had a day in the sun at Lord's.
He did seem
perhaps
a little bit weary, didn't he? Let's call it that, shall we?
Well, like so many, Tim, you take them on and they back down a bit.
Yeah.
And I think that Willis thrived. It's interesting. We're going off tack here now, but back to broadcasting a little bit. To me, it's what you've just been talking about again. You had the package on Sky where the highlights expanded to a decent 2 hours worth, and you then, 2 years ago, had an hour's worth of the verdict, which was real, in-depth analysis, around a table, worked ever so well. And clearly, the attention spans of the Twitterati don't run to shows like that, so you get an hour's highlights, and then half an hour's debate, no longer the verdict, repeated ad nauseam four times in the evening.
Yeah. Yeah.
I find it all very, very strange, but let's not go there. Anyway, James Taylor, new book, and this particular article, and I'm not going to go into details, but the former batsman recalls a turbulent relationship with England's most divisive player that turned his bow against South Africa sour, and the headline is, "My Test Debut, and I Lost All Respect for Kevin Peterson."
Mm.
And without quoting from it, quite apart from the foot and a half difference in height, Taylor pulls no punches at all, and he says that during that partnership that they had at the Oval on Taylor's debut, Peterson was just full of, "What are you doing here? You shouldn't be here. You don't deserve to be here." And he wasn't just a foot and a half shorter, he was being belittled right, left and centre.
Terrible, isn't it? And people wonder why Peterson in the end was cast adrift from England, and that just sums it all up. He was a phenomenal batsman, Peterson, but his clearly, in every team he played for, there were problems. You don't get your bag thrown over the balcony by your teammates if you're getting on with them, let's be honest.
Well, as I've said to you before, there will be many, many listeners for whom Kevin Peterson could not and cannot ever do any wrong.
Mm.
And I've quoted to you before Leary Constantine's old line from all those years ago about, "You must allow genius to be wayward because the speed of the convoy is the speed of the slowest ship."
Yep.
All well and good, but there there I was in the palatial splendour of the RAC in Pall Mall in the middle of last month, and splendid company, and the two guests were Jonathan Agnew and Matt Prior. Matt Prior in particular, not renowned for pulling his punches. And I think the idea had been, as that dinner tends to do, that Agnew should interview Prior.
Yeah.
And Agger's, bless him, was having none of that. He grabbed the microphone and he did his 20 minutes turn on the pretext, whether it was true or not, that he'd got to get the last train home from King's Cross at 11:05 or whatever it was. So he was having none of the question and answer thing. He told some lovely stories, and I'm not one for parroting stories. He was incredibly generous about Brian Johnston and Bill Frindle in particular on Test Match Special. And of course, Bill Frindle has the Reigate connection, being an old boy, the late Bill Frindle, the Test Match bearded wonder, the scorer. So he was really generous about them. And when you go to that dinner, you're introduced to the guests as you go in, and you have your photograph taken, which you can then buy for £18 or whatever if you wish. And I'd actually said to Matt Prior, the last time I was in the same room as you was in the pavilion at Brighton College when John Spencer decided that Reigate would make a splendid scalp in your 26 game unbeaten run, and we'd be number 27 and we very nearly beat you. So that was that. And interestingly, one of the questions that the floor put to Matt Prior was about his experience at school, having come from South Africa, and again, generosity in the air. He was incredibly generous towards my old colleague, I'd call him, John Spencer, who played for Sussex and was master in charge at Brighton College. He was incredibly generous about Spence and the way that he shepherded him and made sure that he got enough of his work done to get through. Anyway, the reason I mentioned this really is that inevitably somebody asked the question direct, not a question about relations in the England dressing room in that very successful side. And Matt Prior made no bones. He said how incredibly impressed they all were and how loyal they all were to Andrew Strauss, and what a wonderful achievement it was of Strauss's to defend the Ashes here and then win the Ashes away. And and that was when he came out with it absolutely blunt, and Kevin Peterson went and not only ruined Andrew Strauss's 100th test match with the texts, but drove him into retirement with his head bowed. And he went on to say, and I'm only repeating what Matt Prior said, in that highly successful dressing room, there were 10 England players and KP.
Yeah.
And he said that on a public platform at the RAC.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly spot on. I think that was the problem all the time with Kevin Peterson. He was never really an England player. He was a player playing for England. And that was the big, big difference. It created so much discord, and nobody ever doubted, and nobody ever doubts how much of an impact he had on the England with his batting, but with his team ethics were so poor that it just created too much discord in that team, and he just couldn't be part of that side.
Tim, I'm going to hark back to the other book, which I've only picked up this morning, somewhere along the line in the second half, because it's about a broadcasting hero of mine, John Arlott, and a man who to me was always a very acquired taste, Jim Swanton, but two titans of BBC broadcasting in the years when I was growing up. So I want to come back to that. I don't say we'll do a book of the month every month, but I'd like just to mention that alongside James Taylor's autobiography. Chris Jacobs is waiting in the wings. So I'll speak to you after the news and weather. Yeah,
great.
You've been listening to Tim Bowling and me rabbiting for an entire hour about cricket, and we've loved every minute of it. You're with On the Front Foot. This is Susie Radio's Cricket Chat Show. It's the June edition, and for some reason in high summer, we're having a bit of trouble getting some guests. We're still hopeful that Sanjay Patel, the chairman of Salford's, will be here at 8:30. He turned up at 8:30 this morning, but we'll let him off for that. Welcome back to the second and final hour of the June edition of Susie 103.4's Cricket Chat Show. This is On the Front Foot, and I'm pleased to say that Tim Bowling and myself, David Jay, are now joined by our third Susie Radio cricket pundit. Chris Jacobs has been doing the Tim Bowling usual role of fighting the traffic. Chris, good evening. How are you?
Evening, guys. I'm pretty good, to be fair. Thank you.
It's very good to see you here. And just remind us, when are you off to the States?
Tuesday. I fly out Tuesday.
Is it Tuesday?
Is this Tuesday coming already?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's come round so quickly,
isn't
it?
Yeah, it's quite a nice flight as well. 11:50 in the morning.
Nice.
I was like, I'll take that. Nothing too early. I was like, no, thank you. But, yeah, really looking forward to it. It's going to be an incredible summer, to be fair, out there again. Obviously, second time round, but they've given me a promotion this time to head of sports and games. So that'll be good, because a little bit more responsibility, and then, fingers crossed, taking cricket over there. Because I did it last summer. We brought a... we used their Amazon Prime account, and we managed to get their quick cricket set over there, and they were loving it over there, so fingers crossed.
Brilliant, that's excellent.
We can try and get it over there a little bit
more.
There
we go, yes. Yeah. You could be a coach of the United States cricket team.
You never know. They actually have one. They play quite a low level, don't they? They were playing the qualifiers a few years ago, I think.
Yes, they did. They played in the World Cup, and they are way up market on the ICC World League because Jersey were in Los Angeles two tournaments ago.
That's quite nice, isn't it, Al?
So I think the USA might have been playing in that, and that would have been World Cricket League Division 4 at that point, because Jersey permanently bounced between 4 and 5, and we just hope they don't drop down into 6. Well, we can look back at the Pakistan series, if, as I suspect there will be, we've got time, but let's just look forward. The ladies are back in action this Saturday against South Africa. That's all very exciting.
Well, and also they've got BBC coverage, I think, they're going to have of their matches, so that's
quite
good.
I think they've got TV coverage as well.
Yes,
I believe
that's right.
It's on Red Button on Sky.
Yeah, I think that's right. So that should be good fun. So at least we'll get to see some cricket on the free-to-air TV.
Yeah, Sky have certainly got that one televised.
They've got a pretty hectic schedule this summer as well. The ladies, they're playing quite a lot of. They've got the ODIs against South Africa. Then there's a 2020 tri series that they're playing with New Zealand and South Africa, followed by the ODIs against New Zealand at the end of the summer. So it's a pretty packed schedule for them. Mm.
As we were saying in the first hour, Tim, what price four-day cricket, what price test cricket? It's not going to happen in the women's game either, is it?
No, unfortunately. But, at least now that the profile of that game is starting to be lifted.
Let's look ahead. ODIs, Chris, against Australia, but a very different-looking Australia from the side that endured the disaster that was the South African Test Series.
Yeah, obviously they do. It's a very different line. I haven't fully seen the lineup, but I assume it's a very changed side, because obviously you've got the likes of Warner, Bancroft, Smith dropping out due to the obviously the scandal that occurred. But I'm still not sold on why we need this ODI series.
I know. Well, we were talking about this earlier on. It just seems odd to throw that
into
the middle.
The way this is going, they're all building up for the ODI World Cup in 2019. That's what we're all looking to forward to. But I think test matches, it's dying out and everything, but to have a couple of test matches against Pakistan right at the beginning of the summer, what's the time? Just beginning of June now, beginning of June, and arguably they were two routes, absolute routes, and you're playing five test matches at the back end. And you're playing ODIs, T20s all in the middle. And you're going to have the likes of the Rose Bowl is the four test match, end of August. I guarantee at least 3 or 4 days will be rained off. Oval are holding 7th to the 11th of September. I've had 3 months out in America and come back and they still haven't finished a test series. So I could even get a ticket for the fifth day there and it'll probably be rained off all day. But I think, for me, I'm a traditionalist. Not many people my age will be traditionalists. They'll be 23 hours in and out, have a few beers. I love test cricket. I think the battle between bat and ball, that is at its prime. I think one of the best test cricket I've seen was, it was in a ill-fated series, obviously the Ashes we just had, but I think it was the day, do you remember the Adelaide Test when we had a chance of chasing down 300-odd? It was that fourth evening when Root was on about 60 and Pat Cummins came in to bowl, and Pat Cummins was swinging it everywhere, and the battle between bat and ball between Root and Cummins in that little session.
I suppose it is likely that in the absence of Stark and Cummins and Hazelwood, and you wonder how injured all three of them are, but in the absence of those three, Nathan Lyon is playing, but it will be an untried, untested Australian bowling attack against an English 50 over side, which remains number one in the world, which is extraordinary. But of course we beat Australia at their own game, the one ray. I suppose that's rather got forgotten against the background of the Ashes and the 58 all out at Auckland, that we actually won both ODI series down under. Anyway, predictions, do you think we'll get away with the one day as against Australia?
Yeah, I think we'll have a pretty, I think it's going to be a reasonably, I would hope it's going to be a reasonably easy victory, to be honest. We're whatever we are in Test cricket, we're a pretty good one day side now. Trevor Bayliss has done the job that he was brought in to do, and I think with the Australians are still suffering from the problems that Chris mentioned earlier on. You know, you've got Tim Payne in the press today saying that Australia won't be silent on the pitch. The fact that he has to say that, and that the fact that Tim Payne has had to define the difference between banter and something going a bit worse than that, if you like, tells you everything you need to know. That the Australian side are in trouble. And
I've got a feeling that backs up against the Wolves mentality. I think they're going to come out fighting, and I think it'll be a lot closer series than people think, because those bowlers that have come in, the likes of Michael Nisa, who's waited his time for his chance at Australian ODI level, I think they'll come in with no baggage, so they've got nothing to fear. However, even if they are 31, 32 years old, or if they're just fresh people coming in, they've played the likes of in front of these big crowds in the Big Bash League, and they've played against international stars alongside their domestic colleagues, and I think them coming in, they won't fear at all.
Because yeah, you could well be right.
It's still just a game against bat and ball, because I think last time someone made a comment about Steve, I was talking to a guy I was coaching with a couple of weeks ago, and he said Steve Waugh personified cricket perfectly. It's like, nobody's out of form, you either get a good ball or you get yourself out.
Langer on a charm offensive yesterday in his press conference. My Australia will sledge you, but we will not abuse you.
Yeah.
And in almost the same breath, he's saying they've appointed Ponting as a special advisor. Yeah. So that could turn out to be...
Well, also the notice that the James Sutherland, the chief executive of Cricket Australia, stepped down. So there's, you know, he's denying it's anything to do with what happened with the ball tampering, but I think Australia, that's why I think they're going to struggle with that, because I think they're just struggling as a nation at the moment to come to terms with what occurred, and they still haven't managed to cope with that incident, and all this is just sort of, well, it's almost sort of shrapnel, isn't it, from what happened.
I don't think they properly know what brand of cricket they're going to play yet. I think they need like a sit down with the likes of Tim Payne, the chief selector, the guy who's going to replace James Sutherland, just sit down and see, even the whole team, even get the whole team involved, like the core players, what brand of cricket do we want to go down, and which route do we want to go down? Do we want to carry on our aggressive sledging, or maybe reel it back a bit, and then stick to that plan?
Yeah.
Now, moving things on very quickly, because we'll be able to review the Australian ODI series next month, no doubt. Let's draw a few conclusions, if there are many to be drawn, from the two tests against Pakistan. As Chris says, two rollings over, one each way, really.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think, Chris?
Batting frailties, again. Unfortunately, it's batting frailties all the time with, I think... You've got to say, the England Test side are turning into the Pakistan of old. You never know what you're going to get. You could get 500 on the board, you could get 84 all outs. You don't know what's going to happen. But to be fair, I was a big critic of Keaton Jennings. I thought he just didn't look the part for Test match cricket. I never thought I'd say it. He looks too tall and gangly to play Test cricket, but he only scored 29, but he'd gone away, hadn't he, to county cricket, and he'd done
what he was told to do. He went back to county cricket and he got some runs under his belt, and he's come back and he's changed his game a little bit, and
he was a lot more disciplined outside his off stumper, rather than getting, as they say, philandered last last year.
yeah
Yeah. Sounds extremely painful. I have to say, having sat and watched the Saturday at Lord's, I thought that was as abject an England batting performance as I can ever remember. We did say as we were walking up to St John's Wood Station, it's probably not coincidence that neither Joss Butler nor Dom Bess was anywhere near the Ashes series.
No. It was just dreadful. I mean, you look at the shots that were played, you know, I mean, the way Root got out chasing one outside that was would probably have been called a wide if
he'd
have left
it alone.
That's
his problem at the
moment. It's just dreadful. I mean,
he's trying to hit the leather off the ball on it. That's how he's getting out, a nick off.
It's just awful. It really is just, you know, you do wonder what goes through their minds when they're going out to bat in a test match. They should be knuckling down, they should be trying to make runs.
Exactly.
Not trying to play these expansive shots in the first two or three overs and chasing everything to try and make runs.
Yeah, because it was Flintoff the other day who said Joss Butler's lucky to be even playing test cricket.
Chris, for now, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Thanks for coming all this way for 10 minutes.
That's okay.
Crispin Blunt MP, welcome back to the Susie Radio studio. You were a regular visitor in the days when Andy Smith was doing our lunchtime current affairs shows.
I certainly visited. I'm not quite sure how claim how regular I was. It certainly wasn't coming every week. But
Reasonably regular. Yeah, I think Henry Smith and yourself, it's lovely to see you back here. And we absolutely promise you no politics whatsoever. We're here on a cricket chat show to talk about cricket. And I wondered if we might ask you initially a little bit about your formative years, in that you were a pupil at Wellington College, if I've got that right.
That's right.
And I would imagine, a little bit older than you, that in the 70s, as it would have been, Wellington was probably even more militarily oriented than latterly?
I'm not entirely sure about that, because I don't know exactly how militarily oriented it is now. It wasn't particularly military oriented when I was there. It had passed to being an ordinary a British public school, in that sense that the pupils were pretty widely drawn. There were obviously quite a few military families there, but not to such an extent that it dominated the school in any sense.
So how did sport fit into the grand scheme of things, and how did sport impinge on you pupil?
Well, I had two older brothers who were 8 and 9 years older than I am, and they had gone to school at Bedford, but they were both terrific sportsmen. And tragically, the hand-to-eye coordination somehow avoided me, and I was frightfully keen, but frankly not very good, because I was not as gifted as they were as sportsmen. And so my career at Wellington, where I decorated the third 11, I actually scored for the first 11 for a season, which was terrific. I had a wonderful time. If you couldn't actually get into the team, why not score? And all the people who have had pleasure out of scoring and umpiring from cricket, I entirely understand and get that. I introduced the Bill Frindle scoring system to Wellington College in 1977, which is the year I spent scoring for the first 11.
Did you know that Bill Frindle is an old boy of the grammar school in Reigate?
Do you know? I don't think I did.
Well, and he's gone now, obviously, but good friend to me. I played quite a bit of cricket for his wandering side.
Right.
Very interesting individual. And one of the first things he ever did was to bring a side down to RGS, and he presented me with a Frindle scoring method, great thick book, which I never really quite mastered. I have to say, in those 25 years that I was looking after cricket at RGS, my first 11 scorers were very important people indeed. Some did it for 3 and even 4 years, and they were well-regarded members of the community for doing it. So you moved on to university and then Her Majesty's Forces, and did you manage to play any social cricket during
that
period?
Now that's the key to my cricketing improvement, because I joined the army and I volunteered to be the cricket officer, and then I could get over this issue I'd always had with cricket, which was getting selected, because I was doing the selecting. So I got in the team and I opened the batting, because I was the captain as well, and I ensured that my team, initially a little squadron side in Cyprus in 1981, and then when I went back to the regiment after my time at university into Germany in 1984, that we played a shed load of cricket. And I organised cricket tours, and we went up to Berlin to play cricket from where we were stationed in Germany, and we took the regimental team back to our recruiting area in South Yorkshire, so Barnsley and Doncaster and Hull were the areas we went to, and we had a really good little regimental team.
I suppose that still goes on to a limited extent, does it? In terms of Her Majesty's Forces and sports
teams? I think
they're
under much more pressure now, not least because since I left the Army in 1990, we've been at war almost consistently since, and life has become infinitely more serious for a soldier than it was in my day in the 1980s, where you could actually play a lot of cricket and do a bit of skiing and adventure training and career development and character development in that sense formed a legitimately important part of trying to hold the forces together and keep people interested in basic soldiering.
Okay, so moving on again, you resigned from the forces, did various things, and then in 1997 followed a particularly interesting, long-standing MP for Reigate in our local constituency. And did you become involved with Reigate Priory Cricket Club straight away?
Well, I was invited to become an honorary vice president as the Member of Parliament to succeed Sir George Gardiner, who had himself been an honorary vice president, and I wrote back cheerfully accepting and said, would they mind if I played a bit? And I then discovered they had a sort of Sunday second 11 side, the Reigate Priory Cavaliers, and I spent an awful lot of time playing for them. And
was that under Jim Harmer?
Jim Harmer was absolutely. He was one of the doyens of the
of the
Cavaliers, along with obviously many of the other great characters of the club.
A man, Jim, who has moved mountains as a volunteer and been of tremendous benefit to very, very many families and people.
Absolutely. No, indeed the whole Harmer family have been absolutely terrific in what they put into the community. They really deserve huge credit.
Have you hung your boots up?
Not quite. I probably should have done by now, but I did find myself last Sunday captaining the Lords and Commons, let's say the parliamentary cricket team. We were playing the Guards Cricket Club at Burton Court, where we did manage to get 286. So a nice time game, finished at tier 4:30. Regrettably, we managed to lose by 8 wickets.
Oh dear.
and we had quite a decent bowling side as well. So we ran into some really quite quality.
Who were the notable performances in that particular match?
James Morris, who's the MP for Hales owner Rowley Regis, who is our only first class cricketer in the Lords and Commons at the minute. He got some runs. We had a researcher for Bill Wiggin, a chap called Tom Day, who got a 50 for us. And if you have a nice parliamentary side, it's kind of balanced between 5 or 6 MPs and then 5 or 6 researchers might be associated with it, because the MPs are generally too old and unfit to do too much running around in the outfield. And as ever, we need other people to do the work for us.
I did stress no politics whatsoever, but we read, Mr. Blunt, that in his time in Parliament, Mr. Bowles was a bit of a wicketkeeper. Is that the case?
I've played with Ed against him once. Well, I got 100. I've played the Labour Party twice in my time. I have to say, on both occasions, I managed to get 100. That probably says rather more about their bowling than it does about my batting, I have to confess. Then the Blue Riband event that I played with him in was back in 2011. When we play an annual match against the MCC, which actually we're playing this coming Sunday, which will be my second game of the season, and for the first time since 1939, in 2011, that game was played on the square at Lords.
When I say
on the square, it was so far off the edge of the square that it was almost in the stand. And the quality of the track, I have to be said, happily we didn't have to bat on it because it rained after an hour and a half, which was really, really sad. So we arrived at Lords and
Did you notice the slope? Did it make any difference?
Well, we were bowling on it, so I'm quite sure it wasn't making too much difference. Actually, our bowling was opened by the then Chief Secretary of the Treasury, Danny Alexander, and who was trundling in from the other end, Joe Johnson, I think, was the other. But they're both perfectly respectable.
Couldn't get Morris to come along
medium bases, and I think it took the MCC well over an hour to get to 22 for one. including one shocking umpiring decision from one of our umpires who triggered one of the England ladies who was playing for the MCC. I have to say, the decision was so bad that we called her back.
Have you ever worn the white coat yourself?
I have. I qualified as an umpire.
Oh, really?
In, when I was stationed in Germany.
Okay.
So one of the courses I sent myself on was a cricket umpiring course. And I went off to, like, I can't remember, it was 1 or 2 weeks of instruction down in the British Army headquarters down in Rheindahlen when I got myself qualified as a grade 3 umpire.
That's good to know that umpires are represented in the Lords and Commons too. Mr. Blunt, if I may, let me bring the Priory Cavaliers and the Lords and Commons back together. You must have played on some wonderful grounds. Any favourites?
Well, I suppose the particular favourite of mine is my most recent and probably last success, I suspect, given my age. I was lucky enough to go, we took a Lords and Commons team to Australia this year, and you are talking to a member of the victorious parliamentary ashes-holding team. And we played 2 35-over game sides against our Australian colleagues. Both of those happened to be drawn, but the second game was played at Bowral. At the ground that Don Bradman grew up at, which is now a lovely ground, and it has the most fabulous cricket museum behind it. And anyone who's interested in cricket goes to Australia, for goodness sake, make sure Bowral is on your itinerary. It's a really great museum, and I have deep fondness for that ground because it was a lovely flat track. It was a glorious morning. It rained after lunch, so they didn't get to bat. The game was drawn, but I managed to stagger past 50 and retired. Retired at 50 in that game, so that I remember that rather fondly.
Anywhere locally that sticks in your mind, or would you rather not take sides?
Raggett Park is obviously a super ground. Merstham is obviously another lovely favourite because it sits there. It sits some sort of beneath the towns there. It's very pretty. So I always enjoy playing there. So I suppose they would be my two favourite local grounds.
And you're a member of MCC. I'm sure that people underestimate the amount of hours and the amount of travel and the amount of work that MPs do. I think that's seldom taken into account. But do you get much chance to indulge in your membership of the MCC as a member?
Well, I managed one day there for the Pakistan test. I'm rather glad I wasn't there for the other days as well. That day was bad enough. Mm. it didn't, so that was the first day, and didn't get any better after that.
There's something about Lords, though, isn't there, which the other grounds just don't quite measure up to.
Well, I suppose as a Surrey MP, I ought to put a word in for the Oval. and if I wasn't a member of the MCC, then I would certainly definitely be a member. Definitely be a member of the Oval. Tragically, I wish I could afford to do both.
Oh, don't we all? But how do you see? It may not be a fair question, but how do you see the role of the MCC in the 21st century? Is there still a role for it?
Oh, I think so. There's a special home of cricket as the keeper of the laws. I think makes it in that sense. Obviously, it's an incredibly special part of history, and there is certainly no lack of demand for people to join the club and for it therefore to be very financially successful. Everyone is going to want to play at the home of cricket. So I would have thought it's going to go from strength to strength, and it'll have the resources to invest in really fine facilities at Lords, and people should look to it for the highest possible standards of cricket.
Yes, I was looking at the proposed development of the Compton and Edrich, which was displayed pictorially in the paper this morning. It looks very impressive. It's a fine ground, isn't it? You mentioned Guardians of the Laws. What a great shame that as well as the old Law 42, fair and unfair play getting longer and longer and longer during the duration of the last law book, there's now a whole new law to govern behaviour on the field. What a shame that is.
It is a shame, but I guess it's perhaps it's a reflection of a society that regulates and legislates slightly more than it used to.
Dear old John Arlott always said cricket is an unfailing reflection of the society against whose background it's played. Very briefly now, Mr. Blunt, how do you see the state of the first class game?
It's obviously the development of 2020 cricket. I have to say I'm very puzzled by this 100 yes. stuff. I want on earth they think they're doing
Yeah, we
that.
Were talking about it in a previous show.
I think that's just a distraction, frankly. I mean, people can cope with 50-50, which is kind of an entire day out. They can cope with 2020, which is obviously works well into a sort of late afternoon and evening format or a top part of an afternoon. And we work with Test cricket. Sustaining of the four-day game for the counties, the first class level in the UK. I hope that continues. It needs to be kind of the necessary breeding ground for the international players, and it seems to be in reasonable health. Whether it has to get and if the counties are going to be able to earn the resources from the one-day game to be able to sustain the bread and butter of what might be described as proper two innings cricket, then I would hope that would continue to happen.
I was actually quite interested to see that, in spite of all the dire commentary, there are three rounds of championship matches between now and the start of the next Test series in August. So all is not completely lost on that front.
Yeah, well, I thought red ball cricket had disappeared until August, actually, so that's good news.
Likewise. There are three rounds of championship. Yeah. Peter Trigo was saying last night after he got 100 at the Aegeus Bowl that they'd sum up, move on, they haven't gone through, but they'll be on the bus and up for it on Saturday morning at Taunton. Well, it's been a little short and sweet, but Crispin Blunt, MP for Reigate, we're extremely grateful to you for finding time for On the Front Foot in what I know is a very crowded schedule, and perhaps you'll accept our invitation to come back again next year.
Absolutely. I've probably given you all the edited highlights of my entire career. So
we can delve further next year, don't worry.
Not much to delve into, I fear.
Mr. Blunt, thank you very much indeed.
Well, it's all a great pleasure.
Little touch of Roy Harper and When an Old Cricketer Leaves the Crease. A middle-aged politician has left the studio. We're very grateful to Crispin Blunt MP for giving up his time this evening to come in On the Front Foot. And it's a delight now to welcome to the show for the first time Sanjay Patel, who is chair at Salford's Cricket Club at Petridge Wood. Sanjay, good evening and welcome to On the Front Foot.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for having me.
I think Sanjay's the keenest guest we've ever had, isn't he?
Oh, you can explain about that, Tim.
Well, I had a phone call this morning from Sanjay. What time was it, Sanjay? 8 o'clock? Was
about quarter past eight.
And I didn't recognise a number, and I don't normally take calls if I don't recognise a number at work. I thought, I better take it. And it was Sanjay on the phone saying, I'm at the studio, and I can't get in. And I had to tell him he was 12 hours too early, the keenest guest we've ever had. But you made it tonight. You're here.
Indeed, indeed.
So thank you ever so much for coming. And sorry for the misunderstanding this morning.
It's been a day full of misunderstandings, but the show rolls on. Sanjay, how's the season started, and what are your prospects in the Surrey Downs?
So, season started well with our first team. They've chalked up a few wins, which we traditionally do well early season, and then we hope we'll continue to do that, but generally we kind of struggle a little bit with consistency of the side, so I think we'll end up mid-table, that's our aim, in Division 1. Division 2, where our second team are, it's about staying up. That's our objective. So generally we play quite well beginning, but then middle we struggle, and then we have a bit of a relegation battle. So generally it's quite good for us at that end point.
Three divisions in the Surrey Downs. How easy is it to enter first and second team in those three divisions?
I think struggling is probably what most teams do. A lot of the clubs are village clubs. We previously, when we started, there was four divisions. Everyone had a first team and a second team. Now there's probably 20 teams that have, you know, two teams, and the rest struggle to have one team. So we're lucky to manage to get two, and that's something we're proud of. And we continue to do that every season, hopefully, for going forward.
Yeah, this is a conversation that we have with all but the very biggest clubs, isn't it, Tim?
Yeah, it is. Yep.
Merstham up the road here bucked the trend slightly with four league sides on a Saturday, but most of the smaller clubs have either been swallowed up or they're struggling to field even a second team. In terms of the Surrey Downs, Sanjay, any particularly interesting fixtures, any particularly attractive places that you play at, any particularly strong rivalries?
Attractiveness, I think we all like going to East Horsley on a nice summer's day, wandering down Millionaire Row past all the lovely houses to a very nice picturesque ground with a nice set of facilities, tennis club, and you know, really nice place to go and play. Headley, when we play them at the Old Freeman School, it's a beautiful place to play.
Yes, that's nice.
We look forward to doing that because we're playing them this year. They're in Division 2, which is the league I play in, so looking forward to turning up there in the summer. That's quite nice.
It's pretty much country house cricket, isn't it, at Ashted Park? I mean, obviously, Tim, you know it intimately because of your daughter, and I've known it over the years with first team cricket at the grammar school going way back. It's there's something about that setting where there's a country house and a cricket ground in front of it,
isn't
it?
That's an amazing grab. I think that's the beauty. We were just talking earlier on about the Surrey Downs League, that you do get to play at some really lovely grounds, don't you?
Yeah, we do, and I think that's the attraction, that playing village cricket in nice villages. I mean, I love going to Holmbury, St Mary's, lovely ground, but most frustrating if you're a bowler. Your figures don't ever represent the real value of what you've done.
That's the same if you ever play up at Headley. Have you played Headley at Headley?
Yes.
Because that ground, if you're a bowler there, that struggle. Yeah, Chris is making the motion, the batting motion in the background. You can see yourself carted out onto that road many times if you're not careful.
The smallest ground that we don't play league but play friendlies is Cold Harbour.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you edge for six at that place. So.
Do you play Sunday cricket as well, do you?
Yes. Yeah, we have one team on a Sunday. Occasionally we get two out. Yeah. And that's a great opportunity to develop the youngsters. So we've got a thriving junior section now, which we started 5 years ago. We've got under 9s, 10s, 11s and 12s, so and a few extra boys. So they're now starting to join the adult teams. And, you know, my philosophy is, you know, play cricket. You know, I put them up to bat, give them maximum overs as I can. I remember being a junior and only getting an over at the end or batting at 11. So we want to buck the trend, keep as many juniors in cricket as possible.
Yes, I was going to say, that's the challenge that everybody faces, isn't it? When suddenly they're 14, 15 and it's not 20 overs any longer. And the longer format creates pressure on young men and women. Have you got a girls section at Salford?
No, unfortunately not. Maybe something for the future. We've had a few girls play with some of the boys and that's great. And I think a lot of clubs are now starting to get into women's cricket. It's been quite heavily backed by the ECB, which again I think is a fantastic opportunity for, you know, spreading cricket around. And you know, I think we've played a few teams in Surrey Downs League, and you know, there's ladies playing league cricket, which is fantastic.
Mentioned the longer game and the way in which more overs can be off-putting for youngsters. Sanjay, what's the format in your division of the Surrey Downs? Is it a mixture or is it overs cricket?
It used to be a mixture. It used to be 90 over games, and then used to have a 40-40. Now it's all 40-40. I must admit, the vote that was done was very marginal. I think it was a bit like Brexit. so I think there's a lot of people that weren't happy about 40-40. I still believe in the value that cricket can offer by playing both formats. And I think you play better cricket if you do have the appreciation of holding out for the draw or you know, the challenge of getting the last man out.
Those are some of the best matches, aren't they? Yeah. I think when there's a last period and you're trying to get them out, or you're batting out with number 11 and you're trying to save a game. I think there's some of those games are the most exciting games that you can play, and it's a great shame that a lot of the youngsters will never experience that.
No, and I think, you know, it does make dull cricket sometimes where, you know, the team batting first scores 300.
Yeah, and the game's over.
The game's over. Yeah. You know you're not going to probably get that. They push all the men out on the boundary, and you go, that's not exactly.
Well, that's the
cricket thing,
isn't it, with time cricket? It keeps the game alive because there's the potential of drawing the game. It doesn't matter what the team batting first has scored, you can try and get a draw. And it's such a shame that we've lost that from all the leagues now. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's right, and it's a conversation we've had with virtually every club who's been in the last 3 years to on the front foot. Now, you've got the floor, Sanjay. Tell us about your star players at Salford's. Who are the big names?
The big names. I didn't get paid enough to advertise some of them, I don't think. I think starting from probably some of the stalwarts of the team, you know, we've got a couple of players that, you know, stand out. I think year on year they win the averages, so my teammates are going to hate me, but, you know, Robbie Besley's probably one of our star players. He's bat, bowls. He took a hat-trick this year in the league. Fantastic. It wasn't the best hat-trick, but I saw
still
it.
A hat-trick.
It's still a hat-trick in the book, and he took five that day. So, you know, certainly he's stand out for year on year. His son, Danny, very talented cricketer as well. You know, a lot of promise. He's in his early 20s, so can bowl at pace, and certainly helps to you know, keep the batsman honest. So you know, he's got a lot of talent. We've got a few guys that are absolutely passionate about cricket. You know, our first team captain, Shail Ram, he comes from Reading, actually, so we have a few guys that commute from Reading to play for us. Guys I've known for years, I've worked with them, and you know, standout performer, you know, with the bat, and his fellow Readingites, I think, as we call them. You know, his name's Suri. I think he loves to see the ball, hit the ball. So if there was a six hitting competition, then he'll be front of the queue. So those are probably some of the stars. And apologies, guys, for those that I haven't mentioned. But you know, that was you didn't pay me enough.
there are always sins of omission, aren't there? But that's good to know. So even though it's a bit of a struggle at second team level, the club is in reasonable health, you'd say, overall.
Yeah, I mean, I took over as chairman 5 years ago. Put a plan in place that we would, you know, start to invest in the facilities. We, you know, we've got the best nets. You know, we spent £20,000 on that. I fundraised that through grants, sponsorship. You know, we've got covers, a new electronic scoreboard. We've got a thriving junior section. So my thought is that, you know, we've got a lot of players on our books. We've got about 60, 70 players. But are they always available? No. But in a few years' time, as the juniors come through, my mission is to continue to bring the juniors through and get them playing cricket.
And most of the players, you mentioned earlier that some of the players commute in from Reading. Are most of the players at the club locals to Salford's?
Yeah, I'd say we have a split. So we have people come from Reading and Staines.
Right.
So we've got probably about eight or nine guys.
And that's because they're friends of friends?
Yeah,
just
friends of mine,
always, yeah.
People that worked for me in the past, and, you know, love cricket.
Yeah.
You know? So, and now we've got, you know, we've got quite a few local in the area. Got a few people that, you know, have historically played at the club. You know, I started when I was nine, some years ago. but there's a few of us still knocking around from that junior section. So, Graham Stewart, who's my secretary, he and I played junior cricket, you know, from when we were nine. So it's good. We've got kind of a nice mix.
Yeah.
And we've got a big, our big day, club day's on Sunday, a President's Day. So
that's this coming Sunday.
This coming Sunday. So, you know, we've got two T20 games, one for the juniors, one for the adults. You know, hoping to raise money for Marie Curie. So
that's good. Yeah.
Great charity event, and our main kind of club day. So hopefully the weather's good.
We'll give you a little shout on the afternoon show tomorrow about that, if you're raising for the Marie Curie.
Yeah.
That's absolutely brilliant. Tell me, do you have a programme of social events? Does the clubhouse at Petridge Wood lend itself to socialising?
Yeah, we try and do maybe something a quarter. I think culturally it's changed cricket. Used to be probably very much more family orientated. Everyone was up there till quite late after games. So that's kind of dissipated. So you know, we try and organise stuff around either where both teams are close together, we'll do something socially, or, you know, with the football coming along, maybe we'll have a night out with watching England maybe win. Hopefully win. So we'll have a programme. You know, we'll have a number of other events through the winter. You know, we'll go out and have a sort of evening awards social, which is always good fun. But generally, you know, we socialise outside of cricket as well. So it's kind of a bit of a mix, really.
Tell me how the Petridge Wood ground works, Sanjay, because it's technically common land, is it, including the bit that you play on?
Yep, it's common land. So we have a lease with the council. We have a very dedicated groundsman, Alan Weller. He's been at the club ever since I can remember. He's retired, well, semi-retired from playing. He does turn out when we're really short. But he spends hours up there maintaining the ground. We just relayed the pitch, actually, for the first time in 50-odd years. So it's looking good. It's a very nice batting track. Alan does all the outfield cutting as well. So we're pretty much self-maintain everything on that common. And we have a good relationship with the dog walkers and people that use the area. And we're pretty much trying to be part of the community. And people do compliment, what we've done. Made the place look a lot neater, tidier. And we don't really, need the council to do much, and we work in partnership with the parks authorities as well. So it's kind of nice, the ecosystem that we work in.
Still a bit tight for parking spaces.
Yeah. I don't think they're ever going to change the potholes.
No, that's... I can remember playing there donkeys years ago, and where are we going to put the car, you know?
If you park on the one side, then you can get enough in.
Yeah, yeah,
I
yeah.
So I think I've played at Salford, but I don't think I've played there for about over 30 years. I remember playing as a junior at Reigate Priory for the sort of under-13s and under-14s, and we used to seem to play Salford's a lot. I think we played you about five or six times a season. But I always remember playing on your ground. It was always a nice little ground to play on. It's about a long time ago now, as you say.
I think a pupil of mine round about your vintage called Michael Vagg played cricket at, and his dad was called Brian, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, I think that was our sort of Salford's connection there all those years ago when we were all a lot younger, Tim. Mentioning players, mentioning the ground, the circumstances, I wouldn't dream of using the word poach on the front foot, but do you find there's any drain of players, Sanjay, to bigger clubs?
No, generally it's the other way round. I think we end up getting players from other clubs, maybe not getting the opportunity, or feel they want to change, or they're friends of a friend. I could probably only think of one or two players that have left to go to other clubs, in the last 5 years of my chairmanship, really. And that's quite nice, because I think people are attracted to playing at Salford's because of the camaraderie, the spirit. We are competitive, but at the end of the day, it's a game of cricket. We enjoy cricket, and you've got to learn to win with a smile, but also lose with a smile.
I think you're right. There's a lot to be said for playing for a smaller club where you're playing at nice grounds and there's a nice team spirit. You get a game, and I think there's a lot to be said for that, especially when you're playing all day. And we've spoken about it before. People's time commitments these days are so much more restricted than they used to be. So if they are going to give up a day of their weekend, they do want to play it in nice surroundings with nice people. So there is a lot to be said for that.
Agreed.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You talk about the way the game is played, and I guess the pressure is just a little bit less in the Surrey Downs than somebody who's striving to get out of the Fullers and into Division 5 of the Championship, as Merstham did the year before last. I was just saying to Mr. Blunt when we were chatting before you came in, Sanjay, what a shame with these new laws that, as well as Law 42, fair and unfair play, growing like Topsy or whatever, there's now this whole new law having to deal with behaviour and levels of sanctions and all the rest of it. And I would imagine, I mean, let me ask you the question direct. Presumably, a lot of the time you're playing cricket where the players are doing the umpiring.
Generally speaking, yes. Maybe in first division, we have an umpire who's our president, who's played cricket all his life, who's probably the top scorer in our era, and he umpires. At the end of the day, my view is umpires are human. If there's someone there doing the umpiring, you've got to respect that. Player umpires, I think, generally speaking, there's a lot of players that won't umpire because they go, I don't want to umpire because of the pressure, or they'll go, I'll just do square leg. I actually enjoy umpiring because it actually keeps you in the game. I think in Surrey Downs, I'd say in Division 2 and below, probably not as pressurised, maybe Division 1, maybe a little bit more.
I think it does make a difference when you've got your own umpire, as you say, yeah. Because, I mean, I've played in games where, in previous clubs, where we've had an umpire and people grumble or doesn't always make the right decision. And my attitude is, well, he makes the right decision in terms of fairness. He's fair, and if you don't want to go out and do it, he's doing it. He's turning up every week and being an umpire, and it's not easy, and especially, as David said, in this day and age with the whole new thing with to do with the behavioural issues, you know, I mean, I don't know, do you ever see any problems in that sense on field in any of the sort of Surrey Downs games that you've played in?
Rarely. I mean, I've seen a couple of things get heated a couple of years ago, but rarely do you see that. I think there's enough level-headed captains to kind of, you know, put that to bed. I mean, I'm very much of the old school of, you know, it's a game of cricket, doesn't matter what the umpire's given, at the end of the day you get on with it, and whether that's your own player or the opposition, doesn't matter. And if a club's got an umpire and they provide one, great.
Yeah,
you know, that's
I think it's
as long as they're consistent.
Exactly,
doesn't matter.
That's exactly right. As long as they're consistent and they're fair, I think we all make mistakes. And if you make mistakes, you accept it. And if it's done on a consistent, you know, if it's consistent, there's no issue.
I suppose that's where the double whammy comes, when you've got different players umpiring at different stages of an innings, and this incredibly complex set of laws, which is fine, I suppose, as long as everybody says, look, let's just get on with it, we're more or less play to the old laws and forget about penalty time and forget about the suspensions from the innings or the match or whatever. It's just if you happen to come across the highly competitive 23-year-old who decides that he's going to invoke whatever it may be.
Yeah.
But there we are. Sanjay, we're going to have to wrap up in just a moment. Anything else you'd like to tell us about the club while you're here?
Yeah, I think one thing we're proud of, and we've just won a community award of the year for Sidlow and Salford's parish. You know, the club's been recognised for all its work and effort it does with the community. So, you know, we coach at the local primary school. We do a lot with the community. We host a game for East Surrey Hospital. So we're doing a lot to try and encourage cricket and generally be part of the community. And, you know, over the last 5 years under, you know, my stewardship and the committee, you know, we've achieved a great lot of satisfaction in developing the club. You know, we've got investment that we're making. We spend all our money on making the club better. So whether it's covers, whether it's new machinery, new pitches, whatever it is, my philosophy is we're just going to keep investing back into grassroots cricket. And you know, we've got a thriving junior section. We started 5 years ago with 6 boys. Now we've got 60.
Wow.
And you know, it's a thriving club with a lot of parents helping. We're also running the All Stars program, which is a really good national initiative by the ECB. And again, you've got 20 odd kids coming to, you know, learn how to play cricket. And for me, if I had the same opportunity they would, I think I'd be playing for Surrey or England. Who knows?
Sanjay Patel, chair of Salford's, or Salford's, call it as you will. It's been a delight to have you on the show this evening. Do come back and see us again. We'll have a bit of a longer natter next time. But for this time around, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, it's the first show we've had with mere snippets of music, but that's the way it's worked tonight. And wanted just to get Chris Jacobs back in front of a microphone for a couple of minutes. We've only got a couple of minutes. Chris, are you coming back when?
7th of September I fly back.
Well, that's good. So you're looking forward to it then?
Yeah, really looking forward to it. Can't wait to go again.
It's going to be a great opportunity, isn't it?
Yeah. And very quickly, Chris, how are things going on at Epsom?
Epsom, okay. We've had a pretty good start to the season, to be fair. First team, 4 out of 5 wins. Problem is, we didn't register our overseas in time, so we are bottom, although we are 4 out of 5 wins.
Ouch.
Yes. Twos, we're doing pretty well, to be fair. I think we lost our first game of the weekend to Dorking, and we're the two sides that are supposed to go up. We were literally like in the situation of losing draw, 4 balls to go, inside edge onto the pad, our batsman, trigger finger.
Oh dear. We've
so
all been there.
We are the top two go up, so Dorking are 1, Chertsey are in at 2, and we're 4 points off Chertsey in second at the present time.
Inside edges in the age of DRS. Who'd be an umpire? I'm glad I've hung my white coat up, Tim. I really am. Well, Chris, we wish you every good fortune for the trip. And we hope wherever life takes you when you return to this side of the pond, you'll at least be able to pop into Nutfield Road and join us with On the Front Foot occasionally.
Oh, definitely will.
And thanks for all the other contributions you've made to Susie 103.4. Greatly appreciated. Tim, we seem to have got away with that.
Yes, that was, as you said earlier, rather fluid schedule tonight, wasn't it?
I was quite pleased with our little two-hander in the first hour of that show. And you know, we've had a leading politician and all the rest of it. So thanks for putting it together. And just make sure you're a bit more organised when we get round to next month, which is July. Tim, thanks ever so much.
Thanks, David. Thank you.
And amazingly, that was On the Front Foot for the month of June here at Susie 103.4. We have rather been flying by the seat of our pants, but there we go. Special thanks to Chris Jacobs for getting back all the way from Nottingham. Thanks to Tim Bowling for some stentorian work with the old vocal cords behind my co-presenter's mic this evening. And a particular thanks to Crispin Blunt MP, who came and shared some of his thoughts with us about the game that we all love so much. And a real pleasure to have Sanjay Patel with us. It's the first time I've been reporting Salford's results in the Wednesday afternoon roundups, but it's the first time we've had a member of Salford's. That was On the Front Foot for the month of June. We'll be back in July.